Hello.
Hello, hello,
Hello.
hello.
Hello. Welcome to Bookish Pod. I'm Kath.
And I'm Elle.
And today we are joined by Araminta, the author of One of the Good Guys. So we're very lucky to have her here. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Araminta Hall, and my latest book is One of the Good Guys, and thank you for having me.
No, you're very welcome. We're really excited to have you on. We thought we'd start by a little summary of the book. Do you want to give a little summary to start off with, and then we can like add anything that we really thought stood out to us?
Absolutely. I mean, it is quite a difficult book to summarize because it is very much, if you give the twist away, it would sort of re ruin the reading experience. So I found the summarizing of the book quite hard over the past few weeks. But anyway, it is about a man called Cole who relocates to the south coast of England because he's trying to get over a really messy breakup with his wife. And he just can't understand what went wrong in their marriage because, he's the sort of guy that, a sort of man that every woman should want. You know, he's really domesticated. He wants kids. He's like not going to be found down the pub getting drunk. He's always where he says he is, all those things. So he really, he's really sort of needs a bit of time to regroup. And when he gets there, he meets an artist who lives about a 20-minute walk from him in this incredibly isolated cottage right on the edge of these crumbling cliffs. And they sort of start a friendship. And meanwhile, there are two young women who are doing a coast-to-coast walk protesting male violence against women. And they're sort of getting closer and closer to Lenny and Cole as Lenny and Cole are getting closer and closer to each other. And when they arrive right by where Lenny and Cole live, they just completely disappear. And as happens when a certain type of woman goes missing, the media goes completely mad and it becomes this huge, like, national story. And it sort of unravels from there, basically.
Yeah, no, that's a good summary without giving anything away, I think.
I read this at Christmas, and once I put it down, I went, Kath, you need to read this because I have so many thoughts. And I think it really hits the nail on the head, when we talk about these kinds of like scenarios, these issues, like gender politics at the moment with and especially post Me Too, of the conversations that we have around women and men. So like it this is a really great book if you're gonna go in and have like for book groups, book discussions, etc. So like thank you, first of all.
Oh, no, that I mean that's very much what I was trying to do because I think we are in a post Me Too moment, and I think that we were sort of very grateful for Me Too because I mean you two are much younger than me, but I grew up in a time when it was women were fair game, and then in the like the 90s and times like that, we weren't just fair game in life, we were fair game in the media as well. And I think that Me Too felt like such an incredible moment for us all. I think we've spent the past sort of 6 years sort of almost being grateful that it happened at all. And I think that there's I've noticed this sort of feeling in the last year or so or longer that of just this sort of dissatisfaction because actually, I mean, things have changed, obviously, legally and politically. But I think I sort of feel like actually all those feelings and all that misogyny that we've always known has existed is still there. And I just think that, not enough has happened yet. And, the sort of like the basic idea for my book, which is a tagline on it, is well, it's not a tagline actually, but it's in the description, is you know, if most men claim to be good, why are most women still afraid to walk home alone at night? And I think that's mm-hmm. sort of like the fundamental question. I've just been thinking a lot about how if you don't feel safe in your environment, mm-hmm. you're not ever going to be equal to people mm-hmm. who do feel safe. And of course, that's absolutely not just a gender issue. You know, race, religion, sexuality, all those things can make you feel the same way. But obviously, I'm a woman, and I'm that's my experience. I was writing about my experience of you know, and I do think safety is like something that we overlook, and I think it's like the key sort of marker of equality. If you have a community that everybody feels safe, I mean, I'm sure there's no community in the world that exists like that. But you know, there's such a disparity between men and women in our community. So yeah, that's where, and I think that's something that we have to address next. You know, I think Me Too has started something incredibly important, and we should be incredibly grateful to the women who did that. But I think we just need to now take the next step. So that was really the sort of basis of feeling behind this book.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really liked the exploration of toxic masculinity through the lens of the good guy, because often when we talk about toxic masculinity, we jump to the red pilling manosphere type things, which I think is very much a response to Me Too. So I wanted to know, in your definition, what it means to be one of the good guys.
What, literally one of the good guys? I mean, in answer to your question, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to write, I sort of didn't want to write a thriller, another thriller, because I've obviously, that's what I write about, you know, a bad man, like, you know, a man who's, you know, you can be like, he's gaslit, he's done this, he's, you know, like, because actually I think very few of us come across those men, and I think that they are obviously completely terrifying, and those are the men we're fearing when we're frightened walking down a street, and which is completely you know, relevant, and we, and you know, it's fine that we feel like that, but I think actually much more scary people are people who totally believe that they are good and right. You know, Cole acts in a way that is not, it's a very confusing way. I can imagine, especially when I was younger, meeting someone like Cole and being really charmed by him, because he does do all the things that we think we want from men. But it's really performative. And actually, Cole himself doesn't want to be bad. He genuinely does not think that he's hurting women. And he genuinely would identify as a feminist. And he genuinely wants the things he says he wants. You know, you're not reading a book about a narrator who's lying to you. You know, he's absolutely not lying to you. Like, our society is so structured by and for straight white men, basically, that it's almost impossible for them to even sometimes understand the idea of fear and how you can make people feel, and how you need to take responsibility for your actions, and how you have to consider other people. Because, and you know, it's like, it's just not something they've ever had to do. And of course, you know, there are many decent men out there who are trying really hard to, but a man like Cole is trapped in his own narrative, and the narrative of what he, like, almost like a Me Too narrative, where he thinks he knows the right things to say and do, but he hasn't explored it. He hasn't explored his part in it, or how he makes people feel, or what he wants from women, as to maybe not being what he wants. And I think women and other, you know, there are lots of people in our society, it's not just women, are used to pleasing people, because we're sort of all, have always been lower, you know, socially than it is basically straight white men that we're talking about, but you know, who sort of run our society. And because we've everybody else is always very slightly lower than them on the in the social structure. You know, it's that feeling of sort of needing to please and needing to be grateful. And, you know, for women, it's also very much that we're physically normally weaker than men. So we also, I think there's sort of a deep-rooted thing in our psyche of, like, you know, that thing of needing to make ourselves safe by acquiescing and being kind and you know, and agreeing to things. And I guess a really good guy understands that and takes that on board and works with that. You know, what Cole does is exploit that, and he doesn't even know he's exploiting it, but that's exactly what he's doing. A really good guy is just, I mean, that's the thing, is like, I don't think that feminism or, you know, destroying the patriarchy or whatever is about pitting yourself against men. You know, there are plenty of men who are on this journey with us and who want to learn and who genuinely try to be a better people, or are better people, you know. So I just think it's really important to remember that it's like a certain type of man. And unfortunately, when you turn on your television, they're the men who are in government. They are the men who are making our laws. You know, it's like, it's so often those people that we see. And that hasn't changed massively. You know, culturally, we're seeing a shift, but politically and socially, we're not yet seeing that shift. And it leaves us all in this very strange space. So, yeah. So Cole, yeah, that would be my definition of a good guy. Someone who just wants to learn, basically, and takes responsibility for themselves. I think men essentially often find that really hard, that taking responsibility thing, which is,
Cole finds it really hard as well, I think, in some respects.
Although Cole finds it especially, like you said, hard, he tries. Responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He tries, but there's none taken.
I mean, that's Cole's big problem, is that he doesn't take responsibility, and so he doesn't ever learn anything. He thinks he's right, and therefore he's stuck in this narrative that he's right, and he just can't quite believe that Mel and other women before her haven't seen how great he is. Like, it's so mad, like that feeling where you're just like, I'm this great person. Like, how can no one see it, instead of ever questioning that maybe the problem is with yourself, you know? But yeah, I think men like Cole don't really question that. They're just used to being right, basically.
Yeah. And a lot of men in society are also used to being right, aren't they? So, yeah. But I think, yeah, I mean, Cole's character's like super interesting, and like quite on the nose, I would say. Like, was that intentional?
Totally, yeah. Yeah, it was completely intentional. I mean, I just thought about I don't specifically know anyone like Cole, but I just think he's like an amalgamation of a lot of behavior that I've seen over the years, you know, personally, but also just, you know, in society. And I just think, and it's something I've just thought about for so long, that he's like, he's an amalgamation of all those sorts of things. But yeah, I worked really hard at getting his character right, because it's funny with a character like that, where, you know, normally when, as the writer, you sort of get to know your character so well that you are, you know exactly what they're doing and saying everything. And with Cole, I always felt I knew him better than he knows himself, you know, like I could see through him. So, but as a writer, you then have to be really careful, because, you know, there were often times that I'd say too much, or, and then I'd be like, oh no, Cole would never, he had never let himself say that, or he had never, you know, he has to remain within this. So yeah, he took a lot of rewriting, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like impressive how you've done that, and also how you've like split the structure in that way. Why did you choose to do the structure like that? Was there a particular reason, like the order of that?
Yeah, I mean, that evolved. I always knew I was going to give Cole his own bit at the beginning, because I wanted that sense of that you're, you know, lots of people have been confused about how good Cole is, which is exactly what I meant that to happen, because I would be confused if I met Cole, you know, and I didn't want to create a baddie as such, or so I really wanted Cole to have the first word, not the last word, but the first word. And then I really played around with the structure after that, because it was like I had Mel and Lenny and the social media all mixed up together. And it was actually my UK editor who suggested that I just took all of Mel out and just see how it sat, like, so that, and as soon as I did that, it was really obvious that it was because, like, it's funny because, like, you have Cole, you have a story, an actual story happening whilst Cole is talking. And then you have an actual story happening while Lenny is talking at the end. But that middle bit with Mel is, you know, just a sort of, the story stops in a way, but you learn everything you need to learn about who Cole is. And lots of people have said to me that's their favourite bit. And I sort of get that. It's like this sort of thing in the middle that it was really, I think the structure has worked quite well, actually. And my editor was quite instrumental in that.
I liked the counter narrative that Mel gave Cole. And like you said, I think it was necessary, because Cole left me feeling suitably unnerved. He was creepy. And then I feel like Mel's narrative then was like, okay, this is why I feel this way.
And I think, and Mel is also, I think Mel is someone who a lot of women have really connected with, because she's really understandable. You understand why she fell in love with him. You understand why. It's actually, what's really interesting is I have, like, at two events I've done, I've been asked twice now why Mel stayed with him for so long, and both those times I've been asked that by a man. And there was one time that the audience just, like, turned on the man. Like, there was literally women, like, sort of like catcalling in the audience, and they were like, and I was like, I think that's your answer. Like, we've all been there. Yeah, it was quite
we've
a good
we've all been there.
Because it's normally women who come and see you talk in bookshops and things. But it was really interesting. And he was really shocked by the response. And he was like, and he was really embarrassed. And he was like, oh my goodness, he said exactly what I've just been saying. He said, oh, I hadn't really thought about it. But yeah, I can sort of see. But it's true. It's like, it's so often the onus is on women to sort the problem out, you know. What he was saying is, why wasn't Mel responsible for, you know, leaving or making him see who he was or all these things? And it's like, so interesting that the onus wasn't on Cole to see who he was and to take responsibility.
Why should it be a woman that has to tell him that? Like, my God. And that's the thing, Cole.
But it was
Cole never takes responsibility.
It's like literally women turning round in their seats and shouting at him. It's like, wow.
A lesson learned that day, I think.
Exactly.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, that is a question that people ask. Even women ask that to other women sometimes, don't they? Like, why did you stay? So
Absolutely.
Which is wild. But the other women, the other main woman in the story is obviously Lenny, which she's brilliant. But what was the inspiration behind Lenny?
I didn't really have inspiration. She's just a character that I really wanted to create. Like, I think Lenny is like, I don't know if I'd want to be Lenny, but I'd almost want to be Lenny. Like, I just wanted to write a woman who's like gone beyond, like, what we're all saying and talking about now. She's like, screw this. I was thinking that 5 years ago. I'm now beyond. I'm now so angry that I'm just going to take matters into my own hand. Like, you guys are all pathetic. You're not going to change anything. And I just think it's really fun writing a woman who's that uncompromising and that sure of herself and sure that what she's doing is right. And, you know, what she does is, there are lots of arguments where you could say what she does is sort of terrible. But I mean, I think it's glorious what she does. And I think that, I think those are the sort of things that, you know, women have always had to, you know, I mean, I think everybody has to fight for their space. You know, space isn't given up. And we, you know, any group that's not of the sort of, like that sort of ruling male group, you know, we has to push and fight to get there and do shocking things. And, you know, I was thinking about the things that the suffragettes did, and I was like, what Lenny does is actually less shocking than, you know, throwing yourself under the king's horse at a race, or chaining yourself to a railing and starving to death and all those sorts of things. And I was like, you know, that is what you have to do to get yourself on the agenda. So she was a brilliant character to write, because I just sort of, I mean, that's, and also actually, you know, asking me what the inspiration was, I don't think there are many women living like that right now. So I don't know who would have inspired me in that sense. You know, there are lots of women who are standing up and talking and being incredibly brave. But I mean, if something like that happened, I would love it. I would love that woman.
Yeah.
Good, Lenny. Also, I was really like annoyed that he kept calling her Leonora when she, like, that's not, you know.
Totally.
Oh my god!
I mean,
someone used to try and call, like, this guy at school, and was like, used to try and call me Kathy, and I used to get so annoyed. I was like, that's not my name. Stop calling me that.
I know. Well, I mean, it's such a thing that women say, that's not my name, you know, I've been enough songs about it and everything, you know, it's like, and it's like, but it's so true. It's that thing of giving up. We've always been expected to give up our names, and there's something really important about a name, you know, what you've chosen to, how you've chosen to say your name, or to, you know, and for me, that was just a little fun thing that felt sort of quite symbolic, that he would change her name. That's so typical.
Very typical. So the other voice, and we've always kind of touched upon it, that we hear in the third act is that of social media and media and their coverage of what unfolds. Why was it important for you to include this?
Yeah, that felt really important to me because, I mean, going back to what we said about how Me Too has changed things, you know, you can't now touch a woman on a tube. I mean, you know, when I was young, men would like just literally touch you, you know, coming home from school on the tube in London, men would just touch you. And you know, you'd go into work and your boss would like comment on your outfit. So, I mean, it was like, you know, it was sort of insane looking back. And all that has, you know, that's what Me Too has changed, you know, and we know that, you know, most sentient normal people know the rules of the game and most people abide by it in their everyday life. But, you know, what social media does is it exposes that the way that certain people are thinking, and it's actually exposed it in an even more visceral way than normal, because, you know, you can hide behind a screen and a made up name and everything, and so you can, or you can join a movement like Andrew Tate, you know, and it, you know, in which you can be loud and proud in your views, and you can, you know, but you're still, you know, you're still not standing there saying it to someone's face. And so for me, that's where misogyny lives now, you know, and it's where it's incredibly upsetting and dangerous, I think, for young women on social media now. And I it felt incredibly important because I wanted to show where that this feeling still exists. You know, we're crazy if we think Me Too has taken any of those feelings away. You know, the same people who were going to say it to your face are now saying it behind closed doors. And it's like, so I wanted to talk about that, but also I just think it is what happens. You know, we've all seen enough missing women cases, and, you know, to know that everybody has an opinion, and everybody has an opinion on why they've gone missing and their culpability and how they're missing. And, you know, and everyone gets this sort of, well, online, you know, there's this sort of excitement almost about finding their bodies and their and what's happened to them, and, you know, and true crime is so massive in all of this and everything. So yeah, it felt like I couldn't really do it without it, apart from anything else.
Yeah, I think the social media thing is really interesting. And also, like, I think, so basically I moved to Clapham a week before Sarah Everard went missing, like literally a week before. And I think that whole, everything that unfolded after that was so, I remember being with my housemate, my new housemate that I'd only just met, and we were both like, right, don't go out after work. And if you need to go to the shop, like, I'll come with you. Like, let's not walk anywhere on our own. And like, yeah, it was really scary actually to move to that area at the exact same time.
You know, when women disappear, you know, the ultimate fear is to be snatched off the street by a stranger. You know, that's sort of most women's ultimate fear. And I mean, the truth is that most women who are murdered, which is shockingly a couple a day in the UK, it's normally by a domestic partner or someone well known to them. But of course, the fear of being snatched off a street is what I, you know, going back to the idea of how we're always aware that we're physically weaker. Well, not always, but, you know, most of the time we will be physically weaker than a man who approaches us. You know, if a man wants to snatch us from a street, chances are he will be able to do it physically, which is not something you can say about a man, obviously. But what I also was saying is that the whole narrative around missing women I find so disturbing anyway, you know, not just the idea that it becomes this almost this commodification of entertainment, which, you know, true crime has a lot to answer for in. But, you know, when Sarah Everard or Nicola Bulley or people like that go missing, you know, you can be sure that, within any given week, about 10 women go missing. And it's says something awful about our society that it's always the same type of women who grab the headlines. And we just have to think really carefully about what we're doing there and who we're saying is important in our society and why also we want those outcomes to be so shocking. Like, I think more and more, you know, we want it to play out like it. Like, Nicola Bulley felt like a Netflix series to me, like condensed into a week, you know. And people were almost disappointed when, you know, she turned up in the river and, you know, there hadn't been any foul play. You know, it was really shocking, I think. And it's just really shocking. The women that we talk about is, you know, there are so many women that go missing who are just never, ever mentioned.
Yeah.
Have that in that third part, in the third act. And I think it's like a discussion in BBC Newsnight, trying not to give too much away. I've got it on page 228, but I don't know if that's a copy of my proof. But one of the commentators, they say, well, it ticks a lot of boxes. They're young, pretty, and let's be honest, middle-class white women. Those types of women always get way more coverage than poorer women or women of colour, which is a subject we absolutely have to address in our society.
I think I know the quote you mean. I heard half of it, and I know what you mean. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That there's like, not only do we have to fear going missing, you then actually have to like fit a certain criteria to actually even have your case talked about. And, I just think it's endlessly, I think what missing women do is they endlessly expose how shocking our society is and how biased it is and how unequal it is and still exposes how we want women to be, which is very depressing.
And I really like that bit as well. Like, I think it's really like a really important passage in the book and like really like important for society. And like, yeah, just it is, there's just so many examples that fit that. So yeah,
it's quite pretty depressing.
It's quite, it's not a cheery subject anyway. No, but even like less violent elements of the book were quite, I think, really important to include. So actually, I had a question about the embryos bit. So, like, I was really shocked about the fact that he had to also give permission for the embryos to be destroyed. Yeah, and I just couldn't believe that that's a thing.
It is completely a thing, yeah.
Ugh.
I couldn't believe that.
Everything about that is true. Like, you also have to keep them for a year. It's like a... It is quite amazing when you think about it. I mean, you can't use them without their permission either. I mean, he couldn't use them either, which is a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, which I guess makes sense, but I just think, yeah, I don't know. I found that, yeah, quite fascinating. Really,
but I mean, I didn't realize that at all. Yeah, I mean, it's that same thing of like, you know, owning women's bodies, and which is the same thing as like a missing dead woman. You know, it's like, it's how we view women's bodies, and you know what that says is that in that situation, we view women's bodies as a vessel in which to carry children rather than thinking about the woman's body. I mean, it's a very, because obviously when I was writing it, you know, all the abortion stuff was happening in America, and I was trying to think of a way of talking about how we use women's bodies in terms of pregnancy without actually talking about abortion, because that didn't fit into the story anyway. And it felt when I started looking into it, it felt really incredible to me, the laws surrounding it. And again, that's just very cold. Like, he wants a baby and he can't really understand why Mel wouldn't carry it for him. And that's, it's so crazy because it reduces the part of a woman in motherhood to like a crazy degree, which is how we then get to a stage where abortion is banned. You know, that's the end goal. That is the end result of thinking like that, basically.
Yeah. I mean, it does. I mean, I think we wrote in our notes, like, it does feel like another way to govern women's bodies. And his insensitivity towards her around her IVF as well was just...
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, and it is another way to govern women's bodies, you know, and IVF is an incredibly, I mean, I haven't actually gone through it, but it's, you know, from my research, it's an incredibly invasive process that, you know, you have to be injected and, you know, you alter your body chemistry doing it. And I mean, obviously there are many, many women who choose to do it and want to do it. Absolutely. Yeah. But it is interesting how we still, you know, contraception is so often down to women, you know, pregnancy is obviously down to women because we have to physically do it. But, you know, then after pregnancy, you know, the fact of raising children is so often down to women. It's such a big topic that you could write a whole novel about that.
I was actually, I'm with my friends at the weekend and we were just talking about how male contraception is still not a thing, and we're just
I know.
It's not like the science doesn't exist for it to happen.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you know, I was talking to a friend today about how I've got two teenage daughters, and they are now vaccinated against the HPV virus, which is, you know, what causes cervical cancer, and it's incredible that it's taken this long for a vaccination to come in, you know, like that generation of girls, you know, won't ever have to have a smear test. They won't ever have to worry about developing cervical cancer, actually. And it's so crazy that there was this very easy cure or prevention all this time. And nothing was done about it. And like, you know, I think that the same can be said, you know, I'm sure there is an easy way for men to, you know, you know be responsible for contraception, but it's still to happen, you know. It's really crazy, actually.
Yeah, 100%. It is wild. I'm glad that that's a part of a book because I think it's just another element that we have to deal with, and And
yeah,
also,
and I think, you know, the book is very much about like violence against women and fear that, you know, without it, it's not a violent book, you know, it's not, there's no sort of, there is no violence against women depicted, but it's like, it's about how women are made to feel scared, you know, or we live with fear and we carry fear around with us. And so I did want to sort of explore different ways that that happens.
Yeah, no. Well, we really, really enjoyed it. I mean, Al said, Kath, you have to read this.
Thank you. That's very kind.
And you had that amazing quote. I'm not going to read it because I might lose perception. But it's like on to page 208, if anyone wants to look at it, where it talks about violence. Because actually, like you said, it doesn't necessarily have to be violence in what you in your actions physically, but also it could be coercive, it could be something else.
Yeah
Oh, do you want me to read it out? So as you read this document, please keep all of this in mind. Please remember how men employ lots of different tactics to make and keep women scared. Think of all the times you've been made to feel or have made someone feel physically or emotionally vulnerable. Has anyone ever told you they're protecting you, or that they will know you better than you know yourself, or that no one will ever love you like they do? Have you ever said those words? Consider that those sentiments, what those sentiments mean. It's all violence when you think about it.
Yeah, a lot of people have pulled out that quote. I think that struck a chord, that quote.
Yeah, no, it's definitely struck a chord with me. And I think Al as well, like we both pulled it out, so... Yeah,
but I think it's the idea of, you know, you sort of, I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, we shouldn't, men and women shouldn't protect each other. You know, obviously there are situations in which that's obviously important. But I think if your overriding feeling is that you feel stronger and you know, you and like, it's almost like owning something, protecting it. And you definitely think that something you're protecting is weaker than you, you know. And so that's, it's an odd thing to think about someone you love, I think. Like, so I think it's, I mean, you know, we all feel moments of protection for people we love, obviously. But I think if you feel it too much, I think that's a real sort of trope, that man who wants to protect you. And women have almost been made to feel like that's a good thing. You know, I mean, we're brought up on those stories. You know, fairy stories are all about men rescuing women and all that sort of stuff. And so it's like, it's sort of in our DNA. But actually, if you take a step back from it, it's actually a bit grim. You know, it's like on a day-to-day level, you shouldn't need it and you shouldn't want it and you shouldn't want to give it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. But yeah, no, so we really liked it, and we'd recommend it to everyone if you haven't already read it. We've actually done quite well not to give any spoilers. We're normally pretty bad at that. So, well done to us.
It's, well, it's so difficult because I've never written a book before where the twist is sort of not the point of the book, but like it's such an integral part of the book that you can't give it away. So it's been such a like a balancing act talking about this book, really.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. But just before we go, what have you been watching, doing or reading at the moment, any one of the three?
I've been watching actually True Detective Night Country, which I've been loving. I love Jodie Foster. I think she's just so incredible, and I think she's so brilliant in this. Her character is a bit like Lenny. I mean, it's completely different to Lenny, but it's a bit like Lenny in that she's totally uncompromising and just doesn't care. And yeah, just is sort of bored by playing by any rules. But I watched Anatomy of a Fall as well. That was the best film I saw recently.
I still haven't seen that.
Oh, it's so, so good. And it's so much about how women's voices aren't listened to, and and how women are judged so much more harshly than men. It's such a brilliant film. I'm reading a book called My Heavenly Favourite by Lucas, and I can't pronounce his second name. It's like, he's Swedish. It's like Rigenvelt or something, but it's brilliant. It's about, it's sort of like, it feels like a modern Lolita, you know, about an older man who falls in love with a 14-year-old girl. And it's just, it's so, so good on that thing of men justifying themselves to themselves and not taking responsibility for their actions. And it's really interesting to read that written by a man, actually. It's it's a brilliant book.
Well, I'll have to read that then. Put it on
I've
the list.
I've just written the note.
Yeah, I know.
I just wrote the note.
Yeah. Yes, the tower. It is long. But no, thank you so much for joining us and discussing the book. We're really grateful to have you on.
No, it was thank you for inviting me. It's been a lovely discussion.
Thank you. Very welcome.